are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 9th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, quick interview with David Graeber regarding Rojava. Meanwhile, North Korea says talks not productive, and Pompeo and the United States are gangster-like. And across the ocean, as Donald Trump heads to get, hopefully, booed by the Brits, call it Mexit. Theresa May's government on brink of collapse. Meanwhile, back in this hemisphere, Brazil in crisis. Judges issue contradicting orders about Lula's release. And the Trump administration can't seem to find those children that we kidnapped. And speaking of finding and Trump, he's set to announce a pick at 9 p.m. tonight for the next Supreme Court nominee. It will either be a theocratic regressive or a regressive theocrat. And the new deputy chief of staff for communications in the Trump White House has a racist wife problem, not to mention a racist boss and coworker problem. The U.S. government carrying the formula for corporations assaults breastfeeding and continues a U.S. tradition of making the world not so great again. Trump administration cuts off funding for the risk corridors, and the Affordable Care Act premiums are set to skyrocket. Meanwhile, in Turkey, under a never-ending state of emergency, Erdogan fires 18,000 people. And lastly, Jim Jordan, a victim of a Democrat time travel plot, as the 7th Ohio State wrestler accuses him of giving a sexual predator the green light. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, folks, I am being beamed into the Brooklyn studio via the special radio technology, and also through video technology. We have so many different technologies that are, it's crazy.
Multimedia.
It's so multimedia, and the nutso thing is I can actually see Matt more clearly now than when I'm sitting across like 5 feet from him in the studio. It's a little bit, it's freaking me out just a little bit. Another Monday, folks. Apparently, Donald Trump is going to announce at 9 p.m. tonight who the Supreme Court nominee will be. I don't know. I mean, it's always interesting to try and guess who he's going to pick. And it's down to, I don't know, three or four people at this point. I don't know that it makes a significant difference which one he picks. Some people argue that if he picked Barrett, then it might be easier, look better for the Supreme Court to roll back Roe v. Wade because she's a woman. But then I heard that she didn't do so well in the interview with him because she's a woman. And then there's some notion that maybe Kavanaugh will be picked because he seems to have some pretty strong thoughts about letting a sitting president off the hook in terms of and it's pretty impressive with this guy because he actually served on the Star Commission for Ken Starr. And then, but he learned his lesson at that point where it's not good for presidents to get subpoenaed while they're in office. I can only imagine that the reason why it's taking this long with Trump is that not one of the justices or the judges were explicit enough in pledging loyalty to him. I think they probably all did it in a way that was slightly obtuse.
If I pee on a girl in front of you, what would you do?
And I think their response was probably not like, give you the thumbs up. It was probably I would take it under consideration. I would see if there were any mitigating factors. And I'm sure in the end, I would be judicious in a way that you would appreciate.
What? And then Trump went, where's my Roy Cohn?
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think that's why we're getting this type of delay on the pick. I mean, some people were anticipating that he would jump the gun and call it on Friday. So I think it's also conceivable that he blows it off tonight.
There was only one scenario that would have been, utterly ridiculous and bad, but not going to happen. But like the only plausible outside chance scenario, and that would be his pro-choice sister. Actually, I really did think about that for a day. I was like, maybe he just appoints his sister.
No,
keep it in the family. Keep it in the fam.
That's not inconceivable that he wouldn't do that for to replace one of the liberal justices. I mean, once they get the solid five, he could probably
then it's
play
Dershowitz.
Around a little bit. Well, I mean, who knows? I mean, honestly, who knows? If his sister came to him and said, don't worry, Donnie, I'll protect you. But, it's quite possible that his sister has been waiting for this for her whole life. So we just don't know.
Waiting to put her brother in prison.
Exactly. I certainly would be if I was related. Folks, I am out of town. I will not be doing any MSNBC maybe over the weekend, maybe by the time the weekend rolls around, but I will not be. I'm also going down to Pittsburgh. And I guess when I get to Pittsburgh, I'm going to be going to the AFT, UFT. That's slightly different.
It's a little different.
Conference. I will not be going to the ATF conference.
Enjoying vacation.
And I will be interviewing, hopefully on this program live, Randy Weingarten, the president of the AFT from the Pittsburgh Conference of the American Federation of Teachers. This is all happening in the wake of Janus and public sector unions, and the AFT must be, I don't know which, probably the third or fourth largest public sector union in the country. This is something that they're going to be wrestling with. What do we do in the wake of Janus? And also, what do we do in the wake of the strikes that took place in and around Kentucky and West Virginia, Oklahoma, these teacher strikes, and more? But that's a long way of saying that I will be shaving by the end of the week. And folks, when I do shave, what I use. I use my Harry's razor. Why do I love my Harry's razor? Because, well, a couple of things. The little narrow blade head, very good for someone like myself who has some asymmetry with the nostrils. I don't want to go into it too much, and I certainly don't want to now call your attention to it as I'm on video, but it's the case. I also like the ergonomic handle, but I'm not going to lie. I like the fact that it's a fraction of the cost of some of those other razors, which have been taking advantage of us for an extended period of time. Harry's has been making some of the highest quality blades now in the world for over 95 years. But they know switching razors isn't an easy decision. So for a limited time, new customers can save big on a Harry's shave set when you use the code MAJORITYREPORT at harrys.com. No more overpaying for expensive razors with unnecessary features. You don't need to have your blade look like it's in a some type of glass case every time you pick it up, and it doesn't have to be all decked out like I don't know, all Buffy Rambo-ish. Harry's guarantees you you will love. Don't you notice that?
Like, yeah,
the
I do.
Razors are supposed to make it look feel like you're being rugged or something.
I don't know. It's a little weird. Like you're
exactly.
You're like invading Attica or something.
Harry's guarantees you'll love your shave or your money back if you let them know within 30 days. This is for a limited time only. Harry has a special offers for listeners of this program. New customers get $5 off a shave set from Harry's with code MAJORITYREPORT at harrys.com. That means you can get a trial set that comes with a five-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, travel cover, all for just $3 plus free shipping. That's nuts. Just use the code MAJORITYREPORT at harrys.com. Join the millions of guys who have already switched and go to harrys.com today. Use the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout and claim your offer. All right, this is pretty fun, actually. For a long time, I had one of those devices where you could stick it into your car's computer. Matt, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
And you could get them at like gearhead shops. The problem is, I never knew what the code was. And it didn't really, you had to like, it wasn't just about, you know, plugging it into the car, not so hard. But the other part, very difficult to figure it out. So I had it, I never used it. So imagine your check engine light beeps on. What is it? I don't know. I'm going to panic. I'm going to drive around with the light on and I'm going to panic. I don't have time to get to the, what am I going to do? You have no idea why your light's on. This has all changed now. Because of Fixed. Fixed is like, it's like, it's basically like putting your car up to an EKG. It takes a few seconds to install it on any car that's made after 1996. Anyone can do it. No tools required. I'm telling you, it's literally like plugging in. It's easier than plugging into your computer monitor. And then Fixed will constantly scan your vehicle for problems, and it tells you, in English, and this is the key, not codes, what's wrong with it. There's even an automatic sensor. It plugs into your car. When you connect it to your smartphone via the app they have, the Fixed app, you always are in the know. It's super easy. No more going into the car repair place with the light on and the guy saying, well, actually, there's about six or seven different things that you need fixed. You walk out of there, it's $1,000. With Fixed, you can tell the mechanic what you need done, how much it should cost. That kind of confidence and control is priceless. Like I say, I put the Fixed in. I wish. We have now about, I guess, 30,000 miles on our car. And so we are headed into the period where we get all the problems. But back when I had 200K on that Sub, man, I wish I had that. I had the other machine, but I couldn't tell what was wrong with it all the time because I didn't know the codes. But Fixed, super easy. Took me about 5 minutes to download the app, plug the thing in. Everybody's got it. You just don't know where it is. And the Fixed app will actually tell you where it is on your model of the car, where to look. You plug it in. There's no tools required. And boom, you get to check all sorts of stuff with your car. And if there's ever a problem, you know exactly what it is. Right now, you can get Fixed for as low as $39 each. Plus, you will get an additional 10% off when you enter the code MAJORITY at listentomycar.com. That's listentomycar.com. Enter the promo code MAJORITY for an additional 10% off the already discounted price. Check it out, folks. It's awesome. All right, let's check out a little bit of sound. This was really...
This is disturbing as anything.
Yeah, it's super disturbing. I mean, look, you know, we play clips of kids occasionally at rallies, and, oh, it's cute, and, you know, oh, this kid... I saw a clip recently where the reporter at the rally asked like a 7-year old kid, like, why are you here? At the immigration rally that was, I guess, June 20th, I don't know, a week or two ago, whatever it was, maybe last weekend. And why are you here? And the kid said, because I feel bad. If I was separated from my mom, I'd be upset. And we shouldn't do that to kids. And I feel like that's a concept that the kid, you know, understood. You know, you always feel a little awkward about kids at these rallies. Here's one that's going to make you feel not just a little awkward. It's going to make you feel super nauseous. This is an 11 and a 10-year-old kid. They're two kids. They're at a Montana rally last week when Trump came in, right? And they're out there with MAGA hats on, MAGA shirts. And listen to what their parents are teaching them.
What are the issues that are most important to you that Donald Trump has brought up this year?
Build a wall. We don't want Mexicans. No. Or illegal immigrants.
Uh-huh. And so why is that important to you?
Because we already have enough people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the Mexicans are coming over here and overpopulating us.
Cute kids, right? Aren't they just precious? And you hear, I don't know, I hear laughter in the background, and yep. It sounds to me like maybe it's like their parents. Like, oh my God, look at the kids. It's so cute how they're parroting our racist tropes.
That's what it sounded like to me.
Unbelievable. Really unbelievable. I mean, totally believable, right?
Right.
I mean, completely and totally.
Expected.
But this is, you know, this is how this stuff grows. Some kids there feeling very insecure about their economic situation. But it's in Montana, so screw them. With all due respect. Really, good luck, guys. See if they're, hopefully by the time they're old enough, we won't let them out of Montana. We'll keep that. We'll
be concerned about the reservations and other people in Montana.
Well, at the border,
buddy.
At the border.
So we're working towards the goal is a borderless world, except in states that voted for Trump twice.
Look, if they want,
I mean,
a wall,
look, there are terrorists. There are
maybe
people.
We can come up with a controversy. Maybe we can come up with a compromise.
Montana's beautiful, though. I don't want to give. There's a lot of public land there too.
We'll set up a webcam.
Look, you just have a. You know, there's other options for how to deal with these people. So you still
really
get to visit beautiful places, and they don't bother you.
all right. So look, a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was about a month ago, I interviewed David Graeber on his book about BS jobs. And while I had him on the phone, it was a pre-interview, I think, or a pre-tape, I should say. I wanted to ask him about Rojava. Rojava is an area. It's in Syria proper. Is that right, Michael?
Mm-hmm.
And they're just as it's not the same group of Kurds, but just as the Kurds in Iraq had basically carved out a semi-autonomous region
very,
in Iraq.
Very different politics, but
different
yeah.
politics, mm-hmm. but a similar dynamic. I mean, mm-hmm, you have a mm-hmm. there's a lot of Kurds in that region of the world,
right.
And they have. Attempted in at least several different ways to establish safe havens for themselves. And Rojava is one of them. And that's in the northeast of Syria, essentially. And so they have their politics are pretty unique, right? I mean, they have established a socialistic, very progressive, semi-autonomous state of sorts in that region. And Graeber, I think, has visited there. In fact, he had just gotten back, I think, a week earlier from the time that we did this interview. So I asked him about it. It's about 12 minutes long. That's what we're doing today for the free show. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, this clip of an interview I did with David Graeber, specifically in this instance, talking about Rojava.
I could sleep. I could sleep. I could sleep.
David, let me just ask you before we go, because, you know, just your perspective on what's going on with the Kurds, particularly in the Syrian conflict. I mean, just a couple of minutes, if you wouldn't mind, because it is the least, I think, talked about aspect of this conflict. And
it's amazing because it's like should be considered one of the most important events in recent world history.
Yeah. Tell us why you say that.
Well, I mean, this is the first time since the 30s, really, since 30s Spain, that a group of people who are trying to create democracy without a state have actually been in control of a significant amount of territory. You say the Zapatistas to some degree, but, you know, their control was always mixed. I mean, this is two-fifths of Syria is now under what they call the Democratic Confederation of North Syria, which is essentially organizing on anarchist principles. It's not explicitly anarchist, but they're to a large degree inspired by the work of Murray Bookchin, who is an American anarchist from New York, actually. And their ideas of democratic confederalism. We're going to create bottom-up direct democracy. And they've been working very hard on creating models of how you would run a complex modern society without a top-down government bureaucracy. And the other really interesting thing is the feminist content. I mean, people there told me repeatedly, they said, look, we're anti-capitalist, but one thing we think we've learned from the 20th century is that you can't get rid of capitalism without getting rid of the state, and you can't get rid of the state without getting rid of patriarchy. But ultimately, patriarchy underpins all forms of power. So, okay, how do you get rid of patriarchy? Well, it's going to be complicated. It's going to be a long path, but giving all women access to automatic weapons is a first step, and that's why they have the Women's Army.
And so, all right, so you've just come back from Syria. What, I mean, tell me what that looks like. I mean, what does the absence of the patriarchy, what does the absence of a state in terms of democracy, what does it look like? I mean, how many people are we talking about? What kind of...
About 2 million.
And how sophisticated is the services? And what, I mean, how does it work?
I mean, it's a rural area. You know, this was a farm province. So we're not talking about a place of like a complex banking system to nationalize or anything like that. You know, so they're starting with something fairly simple. But nonetheless, they're trying to create industry from the bottom up. They have some oil. They have a lot of wheat and but they didn't have refineries or mills, so they had to build all that stuff. But, you know, people have cars, you know. Actually, it's quite interesting. One thing I've been looking into is how what they do with cars, because, you know, people don't have driver's license. You know, license plates are optional. There's no real speed limit. And, you know, they don't have any of that bureaucracy. They do have traffic cops in the cities, but they're basically there to pull kids out of cars. Like, you're 12, get off that motorcycle. You know, you're 8, you can't drive a car, cut that out. But aside from that, you know, people just manage it themselves. And accidents are a problem, but not any worse than anywhere else. So they're trying to proceed without that kind of bureaucratic structure. But the women's stuff is really interesting. So every position they have, any formal position, there's always two people, one male and one female. So and it's considered good for two reasons. First of all, gender balance has to be strict, 50-50 and everything. But also, so nobody ever makes a decision on their own. There has to be at least two people conferring on anything. So no one's ever in charge of dictating anything. At the same time, they have these councils that sort of send delegates to higher councils or send delegates to higher councils. They're not representatives, delegates. We're just communicating the decisions from below. And those councils have to have a certain women's quorum. I think you need 40% women to make a decision. But they also have an all-women's council, which always exists to balance them and can veto any decision that they make that might adversely affect women, which, you know, obviously any decision can affect women. So the way it works, they have these local communes, assemblies, and those assemblies will have groups. They'll have one group that looks at health and one group that looks at security and one group that is interested in education, so forth and so forth, the culture, whatever it might be. And each one of those has a women's group to balance it. And each one of them sends delegates to, you know, the neighborhood, the city, and so forth.
How long has this structure been in place? And
5 years now. Yeah.
And what is happening in terms of that two-fifths of territory that they're holding in Syria? Is that
stable? Well, it used to be one. They're doing better now. Basically, these are the guys who took out ISIS. You know, they have the EPG, which is the People's Defense Forces, and then they have the Women's Defense Forces in addition to that. They, obviously, as you might imagine, the Islamists hate these guys. You know, they're the ultimate enemy, especially because a lot of the women are sort of reviving paganism and saying we're fighting in the name of our goddess Ishtar, you know, this kind of thing. You can imagine what the Islamists think of these guys. It's like, you know, as bad as it can possibly get. So they attacked them. And of course, Turkey is trying to destroy this.
Right.
Which is right wing, and like they're fighting the PKK, which is a Kurdish move, also a Kurdish left wing movement, is very related to this ideologically. They also believe in direct democracy and women's rights. All of this is anathema to the right wing Turkish government, which has recently invaded a part of Rojava. You know, at first they used ISIS as proxy, and I can say this. Basically, ISIS was supported by Turkey. If nothing else, they were trading with them, secretly working with them. I met one woman who she was captured by ISIS, tortured, interrogated, and then they turned her over to Turkish intelligence.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they worked together. So at first, Turkey was essentially using ISIS as a proxy to fight these guys, and these guys won. I mean, they basically – ISIS is now reduced to a tiny pocket. So that's why Rojava got so much bigger, and now it's like half Arab. It started as Kurdish. But a lot of the Arabs, you know, communities are really into this thing. People would say, you know, we liberate an Arab town. Usually what happens is everybody says, wow, this is great. We love this bottom-up democracy thing. They don't know about the women's rights stuff so
right.
much. but you know, gradually they come around. They talk to the women. They say if you get the women more involved in economic production, that becomes a base for them to become more politically active, and gradually things start moving that way. So that's been happening. But Turkey now, you know, finally they just gave up and said, fine, we're just going to invade. And they did. What they did is there's one part of Rojava which was isolated from the rest. And the Turkish army simply invaded. There was no pretext. They just came in using, German tanks and British and American planes and, you know, overwhelming military superiority against a bunch of guys armed with AK-47. So there wasn't much they could do. Finally, the EPG just pulled out because they realized, you know, we could fight street for the city and we could kill thousands of Turks, but thousands of civilians would die in the process. So they actually made an ethical decision just to not to do it and pull out. But the amazing thing is this is like just totally unprovoked aggression on civilians with people who said they were going to commit war crimes. I mean, Erdogan like announced in advance, oh, this place isn't really Kurdish. I mean, this place is 95% Kurdish, right? It's really just 40% Kurdish, and they came later. We're going to restore it to its real Arab population. So basically he announced that he was going to do ethnic cleansing. And you'd think that if somebody launches an unprovoked invasion of another country announcing you're going to commit war crimes, that there might be a little bit of a UN cry and people might get upset. Instead, like Germany, Britain, Britain was even supportive of this. Nobody raised any significant objections. Maybe they just muttered a little bit. Often they didn't even do that, even though they were using their weapons to like commit war crimes. And the only conclusion I could reach is the British government, the German government, which were the most strongly behind this, or supplying them weapons and renewing their contracts to supply weapons to the Turkish army as it was committing these war crimes, mm-hmm. Are both conservative governments threatened on their right by even more anti-immigrant populists. You know, you got UKIP here in America. You know, we all know what's going on in Germany. You have these kind of crazy anti-immigrant right-wing parties. So I actually think that the ethnic cleansing and the atrocities going on in Afrin are actually could be said to be the first atrocities, acts of genocide even. You know, some genocidal acts are not totally exterminating them, but they're definitely ethnically cleansing them. They're committing crimes like crazy, driving people from their homes. And because Erdogan said, and he did announce this, Erdogan being president of Turkey, he said, you know, after we drive these guys out, we're going to take the refugees and put them there.
Wow.
So they're relocating all the scariest ones, the families of the ISIS guys, the families of various jihadis, people like that, in the homes of the Kurds that they just drove out. And that's why Europe's letting them get away with it. They're saying, yeah, like, you know, take the immigrants and put them there.
Because this is going to basically, they want to turn it into a big refugee internment camp, essentially.
Yeah, and that way they won't come to Europe. So Europe, which is already paying Turkey directly to resettle the refugees and also supplying them with weapons, is saying, yeah, okay, you know, do what you need to do.
Is there a resource where people wanted to find out? I mean, you know, people can read online. There's a story, I guess, in New York Review of Books, maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. But is there are there any other?
I think the best news source is called theregion.org.
I'm sorry. Say that one more time.
It's called theregion.org.
Theregion.org.
That's the one I would plug. Yeah, it's largely Kurdish writers, but others as well. It's sort of a left-wing perspective on events in the Middle East, but not from a strictly sort of classic anti-imperialist. I mean, I'm an anti-imperialist, obviously, but the word anti-imperialist has become a code word for we're for anybody that the U.S. seems to be against.
Right.
So, you know, like a lot of the left-wingers that you'll see, like, well, they're attacking Assad. I'm for it, Todd. I don't care if he's a fascist who murders and rapes and tortures people. Yeah.
And is so there any other major reporting or document? Is there a documentary that people can see about?
There's a lot of stuff like that. There's a lot of really good videos, especially on the feminist movement, the women, the fighters. I mean, I can't remember any titles offhand, but Google it. You'll find lots of good stuff.
All right, will do. David Graeber, thank you so much for all this time today. I really appreciate it. A pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, there it is. I know it's a quickie, folks, but interesting stuff that you just don't hear really anywhere. Michael, now you've been published in the region, is that right?
Yes, it is a really good site, and I have been published there. But he described it perfectly. It's a left solidarity instead of just, you know, one dimensional anti-U.S. perspective, and really sophisticated. It's a really good site.
Can we just talk briefly about this story and then we'll go to the fun half. The story in the Washington Post about how vicious people are being to the Trump. Here it is. It's viciousness. In quotes.
I like how they.
Can you put this up on the screen, Matt? Viciousness.
There's never any subtlety in any of these stories.
Well, like, you know, it's a quote, so it's someone else saying.
No, I understand. I understand.
But
it's just funny,
you know,
these
but
people's
it, but it appears
drama.
As if they're writing, Trump aides endure public fury towards president's policy. But the first thing you should know about it is viciousness. One of those viciousness-y things that they mention in there, this graph. Most of the interactions that Trump's well-known aides have with strangers amount to nothing more than posing for selfies. So, in other words, actually, they get treated like celebrities. But his advisors have also found themselves subjected to a string of embarrassing public spankings, a litany that began even before he took office. Oh, my God. What horror. What horror are we going to be talking about? Before Vice President Pence is swearing in. Oh, my God. The poor Vice President Pence. Incidentally, he was hated in Indiana. Like, his approval rating was actually lower than I think Trump's is now nationally.
Oh, significantly so. Trump's up in the 40s. I think he was like 20.
He may have been like high 30s, but low 40s. But pretty sure it was lower than Trump's. Before Vice President Pence is swearing in, his neighbors in Chevy Chase, where he was renting a house. Oh, God. I almost don't want to even read what happens next. This is so vicious. They hung up rainbow banners.
It's pretty vicious.
To protest his opposition to equal rights for gay men and lesbians. Full-on rainbow banners on their house. Oh, my God.
That's a real... Well, that was a real spanking.
The horror.
More of a figurative spanking.
Right. And then when Pence went to the musical Hamilton, and I'm curious, how did Pence get tickets to that so quickly?
Yeah. Mm.
So when he was given tickets, right?
There's a special StubHub if you want to do publicity stunts.
Right. When Pence went to the musical Hamilton, I think we all remember this. This was so horrible, folks. I had to make sure that my kids didn't read the newspapers for days because I didn't want my daughter to think that actors in a play, particularly the actor playing Aaron Burr, concluded the evening by announcing from the stage that he was afraid Trump wouldn't uphold our, what is it, our inalienable rights. Oh, the horror, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, well, that's pretty vicious.
I let my kids read about how 100 kids under the age of 5 have been separated from their parents and essentially kidnapped, and we've lost any mechanism in which to identify them, or the other 2,500 or so that have been kidnapped from their parents. I let them read about that because that I know they can handle. But the idea that maybe there would be a rainbow flag up, that is just a bridge too far.
Well, maybe if you're Mike Pence, it is. I do want
to
say...
Go to hell.
Right. You can go straight to hell. This was a couple of months after I think he'd been on the VP ticket, but as of 2016, and he's still governor of Indiana, his approval rating was at 34%.
Wow.
With
okay.
a 33 negative. Yes. So as I recall, it was super bad. It was not...
I'm sure no one in Indiana had the absolute viciousness.
Well, you know what?
Hang up a rainbow flag.
Do you remember when Pence, I forget, there was some big homophobic thing in like 2014 or something in Indiana. I don't even remember what it was. And Mike Pence would come out and he'd be like, well, you know, we've got the Hoosier spirit. It's the Hoosier spirit. That was his big, like, which is like basically we're really polite to each other while we discriminate against people.
Here's another anecdote there, and really, all of you should feel horrible about this story. One night, Stephen Miller ordered $80 of takeout sushi from a restaurant near his apartment. And a bartender followed him into the street and shouted, "Stephen." When Miller turned around, the bartender... raised both middle fingers and cursed at him.
The viciousness.
This is according to an account Miller has shared with White House colleagues.
It's like growing up in Long Island.
Then Miller was so angry, he threw his sushi away.
Good. Which, I love it. You know what? If it affects him like that, and it's as simple as just a middle finger, it's
you're
going
to tell me to F off? Well, then I'm throwing $80 of mine away.
That's great.
Yeah, I would just eat it with
more
relish.
If it's so easy to get his feelings, then perfect.
If I was Stephen Miller, I'd be like, you made sushi for a white supremacist, and I'm going to relish it now.
This is... And then you have something like this. This story is just really, really offensive. On Saturday, Stephen K. Bannon, Trump's former strategist, browsed at an antiquarian bookstore in Richmond,
for metals
Virginia.
Or something?
What's that?
What kind of
probably looking for some Nazi
what, vintage,
text.
Yeah, exactly.
1930s.
Yeah.
Metals.
Yeah.
Got any new books in for Mussolini's guys? Hey.
Still looking for that second edition, Michael.
There was a blogger section on World War
One.
I'll tell you what, Hitler was a good artist.
Apparently. And you know, this resonates with me because today I had to take the kids to the camp and I was listening to Glenn Beck on the way home. And he's, Glenn Beck, it seems like every time I listen to Glenn Beck, he's reading the Declaration of Independence again and slowly. and sort of explaining what each word means, like inalienable. In other words, a right that cannot be alienated from you.
Mm.
But he's talking about how he's conflating the notion of free speech again, where it's like where free speech rises, it becomes a free speech issue if you're criticized for saying something.
Right.
Right? Like making no differential between the state infringing upon abortion rights versus people criticizing us for being pro-life. Like, there's no distinction. And this is, of course, you know, this is, he's on this is very popular in the conservative circles now, this aggrievement, where they try and make it seem like they're being oppressed because they're being criticized, or they're, you know, a bartender told them to F off is the functional equivalent of the state's apparatus infringing upon an individual right. And this distinction is very important. That's why we don't talk about, when we talk about things being a free speech issue, it must involve government intrusion upon this to be a free speech issue, or that speech must be particularly protected. And I don't even know. I don't even know if I have an example of this in private life. I mean, you can be fired for saying stuff on the job, folks. You could make an argument that you shouldn't be, because of what you said. Right. But you can be fired. There's no law against it. That's just the way it is, and it is not a First Amendment issue. So, anyways, Bannon is in the bookstore. And
might not be a First Amendment issue, but it's a Jew issue.
According to the owner of the books, a woman in the shop called Bannon a piece of trash.
That sounds so tame.
You just have to say trash.
What would you say to Steve Bannon if you encountered him at a bookstore?
And so the owner threatened to call the police on her. We are a bookshop. Bookshops are all about ideas and tolerating different opinions and not about verbally assaulting somebody, which was happening.
Womp,
and
womp.
Okay, so but honestly, like, okay, you're the bookstore owner. You get to do that. But here's what would happen if you called the cops. The cops would show up and they would go, seriously? I'm sorry. Did you just call us because someone called somebody else a piece of trash? You told the lady to leave, right? Did she leave? Oh, she did? Oh, okay. Now, here's
the other woman
question.
Black, ma'am?
Here's the other question. How did the Washington Post find out about this story? Right? Like, do you think the owner of this bookstore said, I've got to get to the Post about this? This is like the Pentagon Papers. I've got to let them know that a lady in my store called Steve Bannon a piece of trash.
I got to coordinate a meth deal.
Steve Bannon, whined about it to the reporter. Because there's another story about Steve Bannon, and this is really just the idea that there are two of these stories, folks, is just heartbreaking. While he was a part of the president's team, Bannon dealt with enemy life in Washington, a city he freely described as enemy territory. Oh, I see. Okay. So he called it enemy territory and then wondered why people called him a piece of trash. Okay, fair enough. By hiring security and rarely venturing out in public. As if this is any different than Steve Bannon, any report of the way Steve Bannon has acted in his entire existence, right? This is a guy they found his rental apartment in Florida. The bathtub was corroded from acid.
Just take it out of context.
When Bannon traveled, it was usually aboard a private plane. Never does it appear that the Washington Post said, how did you used to travel before? A private plane.
It was because I've been in a lot of different, every city I've lived in and wanted to conquer because of my rage and narcissistic projection of the world is enemy territory. Because I wanted to be in L.A. and in Washington.
Check the
are you a Jew? Stop asking me questions.
Here's the story of
what would
Sean
you
Spicer.
Say to real quick? What would you say to Steve Bannon if you saw him at a bookstore?
You're a piece of trash.
Right.
My understanding, sir, is that you're a piece of trash. A White House reporter once on the phone with Sean Spicer while the then press secretary was standing in his yard in Alexandria said he could hear a passing motorist shouting curses at him. Good. Good. How could you be sure that for you?
I love how that's Spicer, too. It's like all the other ones get like these personalized interactions, but Spicer just gets the guy like, hey, asshole.
A drive-by.
Hey, you're a loser. You can't even get a TV contract. Hey, the only thing you've ever contributed to society was Melissa McCarthy doing a funny impression of you.
This is unbelievable. You don't even get stories about this for like... You know, I don't know, celebrities who have to deal with the public.
Well,
this
wait, is it true that, and I'm reaching here, you would know this better than me, but was it true that there was some, like, priest that wouldn't give John Kerry communion when he ran for president because he's pro-choice?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Were there whining articles about that?
Of course not.
Right.
Of course not.
Right.
I mean, give me a break.
The guy couldn't even find refuge in his own church. I mean, that actually... I'm not, you know, sentimental about those things, but if anything, I mean, that seems to me like a lot more of a real thing than someone says at a bookstore, hey, you're a jerk.
I mean, can you imagine if you had to turn on, well, I mean, I just talk about the abuse that Janine Garofalo got back right. in the day when she was the reluctant face of the anti-war movement. I mean, they were blowing her up in comedy movies. They were, she was being maligned from television programs. People were stopping on the street and threatening her. People didn't read about it because she wasn't whining to the Washington Post about it. Or can you imagine, like, can you imagine being someone who, where you would turn on your TV and see entire arenas yelling, lock her up? Or doing like the you know Indian tomahawk yeah. chop because and or maybe the president of the United States calling you Pocahontas. I mean, this is such garbage. It is indicative of the two-prong strategy, and we'll talk about the other prong that the Republicans have for the fall that is not going to work. One is that. These conservative icons are being maligned. But here's the problem with why that's not going to work to motivate Republican voters is because I don't think the Trump voters are going to vote no matter what. But I don't think, broadly speaking, Republicans who would vote for Trump actually give a crap about Steve Bannon or Steve Miller or Donald Trump, for that matter. They just want what they can get out of these guys, which is like, you know, terrorize immigrants, cut my taxes, then also, you know, crap on black guys who are making too much money.
That's
basically it, right? I mean, that's the Republican agenda. And they're just not moved in any way by the slights on Stephen Miller that he has to throw out his $80 worth of sushi because he's just so disgusted. God, I couldn't even put that piece of tuna in my mouth knowing that that bartender said F you to me. I couldn't even do it.
What an unbelievable. Yeah, really,
like, this is the worst story they can come up with. Not like, oh, someone left a dead pig's head like on the back seat of your car. They broke into my car and left a dead pig's head. Like that might be like, oh, that's a little disturbing. But a bartender said F you and you decide to throw out your own sushi, that's going to motivate people to vote. The other one is that the entire Democratic Party has been taken over by this woman who won a primary in New York, as opposed to like, oh, Bernie Sanders, right? Like they tried to, they're so muddled in their attempts to motivate Republicans to go out and vote that they can't find anything. And I don't know. It's funny to watch them flail. But we'll talk.
Well, yeah, but they're really. What's so funny about
when we go into the fun half, we'll play this really stuff with Cornel West.
And Huckabee, too.
They are seriously aggrieved. I mean, it's incredible. You've read the column that come out every couple of months about how hard it is for Trump administration officials, like in their 20s and 30s, to go to date in Washington.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that last week.
It's just incredible. It's like.
Yes. It's super hard, but no one cares.
And no one cares.
Here's the thing is that the reason why they don't feel that pent up, and we'll play this clip of another, you know, example of a white guy who decides like, oh, I've deputized myself and I'm going to make sure that this black person actually belongs in this area. That's I'm now a deputy, a self-identified deputy. But the pent up, you know, the anti-PC that was pent up, right? This notion of like, I'm aggrieved because I can no longer say like, hey, what's this black person doing in my neighborhood? That's gone now for them because they all feel like they can. They all
Mitt
feel
Romney.
Like
Mitt Romney
total,
said it. He said
total,
it.
What's that?
Trickle down racism.
Yes.
He was correct.
Yes. They all feel like they now have this sort of license to express it. It's Trump time. And fortunately, now I have my free speech back again, where I don't feel guilty about telling the dirty immigrants to get out. I can teach my kid that Mexicans are overpopulating us. That's the era.
In Montana.
In Montana, right. We have no room out here. Too many Mexicans.
You know, I did see Norm MacDonald, of all people, who if anything, I thought his politics were a bit to the right. I don't know much about him, but he actually did a riff a while ago, which just registers at least that some of this PC thing is kind of starting to burst in some ways in the culture, because he was doing a routine about Cosby, and he was like, you know, when is a rapist going to come forward and be like, you know, I'm not PC. I like to rape people. Sorry to not be politically correct. And it was like, right, that's exactly where that would fit. That is exactly. I think even the pedophile guy who was running as a libertarian said something like that. You know, like, I'm not politically correct, which is why you'll find me writing criminal things on internet forums about assaulting children. I'm just not PC.
Right.
Just a stand-in for being loathsome.
All right, well, listen, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be in the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, you can make this show possible, and our members do, and you can join them in making this show possible every single day by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It is the support of our members that makes this show possible, period, end of story, no other part of the story. There's no other part of the story. There's nothing that mitigates that story. There's nothing that cuts against that story.
Nothing that enhances it.
Nothing that enhances that story. Well, nothing, I mean, things can enhance it. I mean, they also, I mean, our listeners, we obviously couldn't do it without our listeners, but we wouldn't do it without our listeners, but we couldn't do it without our members. You can be one of those people at jointhemajorityreport.com as a way of saying thank you. We give you the fun half, ladies and gentlemen, where we play more clips, where we occasionally mock conservatives. Sometimes we will do some serious stuff. We have some interesting debates in the fun half. You never know what you're going to get. That's why we call it the unpredictable fun half. I just made that part up.
Super unpredictable, Rachel.
Sometimes
you can predict certain lanes.
25 minutes with a libertarian.
25 minutes with a libertarian.
The fact
zero
that
sum game.
Predict, but not
a stammer here and there. There are some things we can predict.
If you want access to the fun app but don't have the financial means, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. It'll take a moment, but maybe it'll take a week or two or three. But we will get you and hook you up.
Occasionally, a gentleman who sounds like he is high on Robitussin will have a theory about IQ and black people.
It happens. It happens. I'm not going to lie, folks. Today is Monday. Tomorrow will be Tuesday. And then Tuesday night is the TMBS night, the Michael Brooks Show. And you can subscribe to that on iTunes. You can watch it on our YouTube channel. You can get it through your Patreon, get the added bonuses. Who's on the program tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night, a lot of Brazil material, and then Harvey Kay, who's a FDR and Thomas Paine scholar, is going to be in studio. We're talking about the Four Freedoms and democratic socialism in America.
He's been on.
He's been on Majority Report. Yep.
Is he in New York?
No, he's visiting town.
Oh, nice. All right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun.
By the way.
Sorry. Yes. Sorry about that.
Brand new episode of the Literary Hangover, episode 3 dropped, Sleepy Hollow.
Sleepy Hollow.
Yep. So YouTube, Patreon, all that stuff. It's everywhere. And every Stitcher, all that.
You got all the different distribution channels, don't you?
I love the way when we were starting TMBS, Matt was like, yeah, Stitcher, it's going to take a little while. A Literary Hangover is available. There's a site in Chinese.
I'm going on
the Senjiao province.
Going on the Rubin Report to talk about incentives.
I'm going. Yeah.
Michael, I would also just be very, very careful of the extremely fragile glass house that you are living in when it comes to
which part?
The idea that like. A producer on a show doesn't know how to produce certain things until they're in a position to do their own show. That dynamic,
refer back to the underpaid and incentive comment. You're right, Matt.
There you go.
Fair enough.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, continue this argument there. Also, don't forget to check out The Antifada at patreon.com/TheAntifada. Jamie is in the at the Socialist Convention in Chicago. She's going to come back tomorrow. We'll have a lot of stuff, I think, that she's going to be including in that program. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be back in a moment.